So, how did the count come out?
So there were, for the first four, the chair, vice chair, secretary, treasurer, and secretary, shockingly, all four of those were indeed.
Oh my goodness.
So the chair, Chris Deckard, vice chair, Steve Turnage, treasurer, Greg Mauser, and secretary, Gary Louie.
You're back.
Congratulations.
For the committee candidates, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 candidates, and we voted for 5. So the top 5 vote-getters out of those, and then on top of that, there was one write-in of one name by one person. But not counting that, of the 7 that were on the ballot, the 5 top vote-getters were Dan Mortensen, Dave Tosti Lane, Bob Smith, Mike Metesky, and Renee Yeager.
So I'm going to go back to a little bit of the slideshow for a little bit. Because it's so exciting. So this is something like just a little, I was actually talking about this at the break a little bit, but the idea is that like we talked about the math of these old reverbs, and it's like basically the math was, you know, nowadays there's arguments about 32-bit floating point versus 32-bit fixed point versus 64-bit floating point. 1970s, if that's not what you're talking about, like a 16-bit AD or DA converter, you couldn't get it, or you could, but it's, you know, it's too. I mean, if it's something's too expensive for an $8,500 reverb, that gives you an idea of how expensive it is. So what they did is that they used 12-bit converters. There's like the one that's like, I forget the name of it. It's like probably something 80 or something, and they have this technique where they're monitoring the signal level in real time, and then they're just sort of scaling the input to the converter, so it's always like, you know, a couple of bits. So try to keep the scale into most of the high part of the converter for as long as possible, in both the input and the like, and the input while sending a signal to the computer, letting you know what the scale was, and then the output is similar, kind of the reverse process. It's like you're the DAC actually would be jumping around between, like, trying to keep it in as much of the audible range as possible, while they had this, I guess, a resistor network or something, like something that would be instantly changing the gain of the output, but depending on what the, so you'd, it's a way of getting like 15 bits, I think, of dynamic range, or maybe even more out of a 12-bit AD or DA. But it also, when you have the signal hanging around at those higher volumes, that's still a 12-bit signal. So there's quantization, and then there's going to be, there might be a little bit of like jumping around when it goes between those states. So like, if it's not, I don't know. I mean, there's probably some noise there, but
dithering.
It's not really dithering. Would be more like
averaging, oversampling.
Oh no, it's like, it's more just like noise. Not, it's not necessarily good. Like it's just, and like dithering is like the dithering noise. Like, because I heard this was listening to an AMS RMX 16. It's like, oh, is there dithering noise in there? It's like, no, that is quantization noise.
These, and it would be quantization distortion versus dithering noise?
It's,
or is that just...
Well, quantization distortion, I mean, there's going to be distortion is like something like an early Lexicon would have a 16-bit by, was it 6-bit multiplier, or...
We had 5-bit multiplier.
And it had a 20-bit accumulator of headroom, which meant that you can get like 4 bits of headroom inside before it starts clipping, which sounds fine, except you realize that the gain inside of some of these building blocks that they used could get really high. So you could get clipping, especially at long reverb times with a lot of bass boost. And but then you also have just this noise, which happens. Like if you got like basically you're multiplying the signal, you know, a 16-bit signal by a 6-bit coefficient, there's going to be noise that accumulates every time it goes around that feedback path. Like a digital filter like that will actually have a fair amount of quantization noise. And then when you have a whole bunch of those strung out in this loop and it's going around and around the loop, it's like this noise builds up. And then it's like, so you have a lot of this quantization and truncation noise in these reverbs. And but it's also interesting because you also will have, like, in order to get the best signal to noise performance, you would have pre and de-emphasis, which kind of helps shape that noise and make it sound more like an analog noise. But what's also, I've never heard anyone talk about this, so I mean, like, it'd be interesting paper for someone to write that actually knows math. But
can you hit play?
Hmm?
Can you make it tape?
Oh.
There's the play button down below.
Oh, the play button. Thank
That's
you.
The one. Thank you.
Oh. I've used this for all of 2 days. It's like, but like, my theory, and this is just a theory, is that like, that noise may not be a bad thing. It's like, it's blurring the resonances and blurring the echoes. So each of these echoes is got a little bit of crunchy noise, but it's like, if you think about the real world, you know, going off any of these surfaces here, you're not going to get straight echoes. It's going to go different directions for different frequencies. And that's, so something that kind of like, it's not a physical model of the real world, but it's just like, it might be something that our ear hears is kind of similar.
Well, so why would this noise be, it's a correlated noise.
Exactly, it's correlated with the signal. Although there is, like, there's limit cycles down at the, like, once everything dies away, there's limit cycles, and that's like what I heard on the AMS processor. It's like, there's just noise there, and it's like, and the noise is increased as
you turn. Even with no signal, you can kind of hear.
Yeah.
Well, you add a little bit of white noise in it, you have a perception of having more highs.
It's, yeah, and like, and also, like, that noise will be different for left and right. And they've done experiments where if you add a little bit of mid-range noise for like not from independent noise sources for left and white channels, just that kind of increases the stereo perception of something. So this, you know, these clipping and quantization truncation might be increased, like kind of increasing the stereo image. And I don't really know. I've just like, it's like, it's one of these things that's like, I just kind of try to figure out how do I model something like that and how does it sound? And it's like, I'm not necessarily modeling it correctly, or I might do something that's inspired by that model. I cheat because I don't really want to program in 16 by 6 bit multipliers if I can avoid it. It's yeah, people that have done that, like I know that there's a guy at who was at Lexicon for like 19 years before forming his own before he got laid off, the last guy from Utah that got laid off at the last from the original Lexicon. Form his own company, and people ask, are you emulating that stuff? He's like, no, I'm so happy to get away from it. I hate that stuff. I want nothing to do with that. But for me, I kind of find it interesting. And then there's also other, like I did put in here, there's other weird noises in these old processors, because they might have like an 8-bit controller modulating things, so you'd have this stepped waveform that modulates it. So like, I remember listening to this one reverb, it was like, oh, run a sine wave through it, and it's modulating, and it sounded like a modem. There's just like this noisy sidebands below that with a sine wave, which is weird, but it's like, well, how many people are running a sine wave through it? You know, it's like, and that's, you know, it's like, it's not about the test signal, it's about how it sounds in the, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, people do, but.
So I guess I would, but that's, so would that be kind of a lower frequency modulation of the delay line than what you were talking about earlier?
It's what it is. It's a modulation of the delay. It's more like that waveform that's modulating the delay line has got steps.
Yeah.
It's a little bit staircasey. And that ends up adding little bits of modulation noise to the waveform versus like a pure, like, you know, let's say it's a sine wave or something like that, which it isn't. But it's like the sine wave, it's like, you know, it'd be like very continuous. Like, this would be more like, like you have these stair steps in there.
Well, you got to reconstruct
it, then you have like this high frequency.
Well, in this case, it's not reconstructed. It's just a modulation signal that's driven from some little 8-bit processor that's driving something. It's like, and you know that 8-bit processor was driving everything. Like I've heard about, like on the 224, like when you had this chorus going, it's like the delay would flicker. Because it was doing everything. It's like all the cycles were going through. It's like, we can't update. I mean, I don't know exactly how it works.
Conversions come quite a ways since the 80s.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so like that gets us to the 80s. Like, you know, it's like you'd hear digital reverbs everywhere in the 80s. And they were really loud, and drums were big, and they had DX7s. And I'm like, honestly, I do have mixed feelings about that. I love programming reverbs, and I love the like designs and like thinking about 80s reverbs, but I don't always love to hear it like that. But it's a job, so that's fine. That's a great job. But that's my biggest complaint.
Isn't there a lot of competition?
Yeah, sure. Just have to, yeah, but that's okay. That helps make it better. And it's like, but so in the 80s, like they really stopped. Like it wasn't just doing it for like, to simulate a concert hall or to like kind of flesh out a mix the way that it is. Like you're starting to use it for making things weird and making things sound loud. So like this is an example, the 224XL, which is probably my favorite reverb I've ever heard. It's like the 224, but it's got a much higher bigger bandwidth, like high frequencies go up to 15 kilohertz. and they have these rich chamber and rich plate, which were like awesome, and like they just really sound like more echo density, kind of clearer. And I was like, I'm just, for whatever reason, they didn't come up with one called Rich Hall.
Is that Rich Hall?
That's Rich Hall. Yeah, it's like the 480 L came, the 224 came out, I think 1984, and that's when Rich Hall was on Saturday Night Live. So if they were ever going to have a Rich Hall algorithm, that's like, I think that kind of, the name was taken.
So was the 224XL, was that a huge, was the architecture completely different, or is it, did they just make it better?
All we did was increase the bandwidth. So add more memory and increase the converter bandwidth.
So like, so basically that, so that would imply like that, like these algorithms I like could have run on the 224 or 220, the original 224.
A lot of them were, and I think the reason the Rich Hall wasn't done, Dave didn't believe there was such a thing as a Rich Hall. The critical thing about Dave's programs is he was an expert on Hall sound. He was a classical recordist, and he listened to halls and measured halls. And the critical thing in a hall is the buildup of the initial reverb. That really distinguishes the characteristic of the hall. And that, you don't want this instant buildup like a playhead. The big challenge for him was making a plate sound, because you need to generate these incredibly fast, almost immediate, echoes, very dense, okay? And that's hard to do with the Schroeder topology.
Yeah, it's like, I know it's like you can put all passes in series to instant, like, well, this, I say instantly build up the echo density, but it doesn't, because I can play something later on. It's like, a bunch of all passes in series, like all pass delays, kind of smooths out the initial attack. You get a lot of echoes, but it smooths out. And so it's really hard. It's like, how do you get this really sharp instant attack and have instant echo density? So that's something that people are still trying to figure out.
Can you still get those on eBay?
No, 224XL?
Yeah.
I've got $2,000, yeah.
Really?
Oh yeah, and I that's the one, if I was going to buy something for $2,000 that's going to fall apart at any moment, I would get, I love that. So
are their plug-ins just as good as their hardware? I remember when they were starting to do some plug-ins.
Yeah, UAD does have that.
So what did you think of the 480L?
We're getting there. So 480L. So from my understanding of it, outsider, like just looking at the stuff, testing it, it seems like they kind of like the basic architecture is more like the rich algorithms of the 224XL. And I forgot stuff like they have the random hall, which doesn't have chorusing, and they took the chorus. As far as I could tell, it sounds like sounds to my ears like they took the chorusing out of the main reverb algorithms. They had like they had a classic cart that had it. One other thing I forgot to add, like talking about the concert halls, they added shape and spread. And that was the ability to like shape the initial attack of the sound, and spread allows you kind of like over what time that happened. So you can go from a very sharp attack to something that fades in more over time, and to something that fades in over a longer time, and somewhere like, and that will give you the ability to like a concert hall, but also kind of helps push the sound away from the source in a mix that sounds maybe more natural than pre-delay. It's a neat thing, kind of like that, like having, it sort of fades in a little bit. If you can control that, it's cool.
And based on input level?
Just anything would fade based on, this wasn't a dynamic thing. They had dynamic gates for like cutting off the stuff. And they had some weird things based on input level that I don't really understand. I think I only heard heard it a couple of years, last year. I was like, well, I'm not going to put in a plug-in now that I figured out. It's like, too late. It's like, whatever. I mean, because that's the sort of thing that you really need to, like, something that's based on input level, you want to be able to control the input levels. But it's higher sampling rate, full audio bandwidth. Was it 16-bit converters? Or?
Yes.
It's had, like, 18-bit integer, but honestly, that is better. It's like, you know, like, when you listen to, like, when you, like, going between bit levels, like, you get a pretty instant thing, so... But there still was that kind of interesting, like compared to like a plug-in version of it, there's still some interesting color and character in those. And yeah, it's like my experience with the 480L, I prefer the 224XL, but I haven't found a 480L in town that actually has Random Hall as one of the carts. Like the ones I've rented have an older ROM version. So
are the cartridges presets then?
The cartridges, like, the cartridges are actually new algorithms, like, totally change, like, what it is. Like, so you could get a cart that, like, the classic cart would have the rich plate and the concert hall from the 224 XL, or something like that, close enough.
Like, just two, how many presets would be on a cartridge?
There'd be X number of presets per algorithm, but, like, I think, like, there might be, I don't know, anywhere between one and several algorithms on there. Like, there's one, the surround cart, that is like this rare beast that people have heard it said is like, oh, it's the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. Yeah. Just like, but I've never, I don't know anyone that has one. And this is another one. It's like, speaking of not knowing anyone that has one, this is like this German device, the Quantec Raum Simulator. And it's, and they did a very different model. Like, they were one of these people that very much set themselves, like, we aren't doing what the competitors do. We are simulating the resonances of the room. Mm-hmm. And so, which is cool, except for it's like, they're like, they could have like up to, this model could have up to 3 resonances per hertz, which is cool, except for a real room at 1,000 hertz where you listen to it might have several thousand resonances per hertz. But still, these things were used on great music. They had a great kind of natural attack, and they could have infinite reverb, which I don't know. Other ones start having that too. This is
sorry. When did the 480? When did that one come out?
86, I think.
And I noticed, since the next slide you had the German. So did
that was 81.
It never. Oh, this 81? One's 81.
81. They came out with, like, but they still make a very expanded version of it.
Well, it just occurred to me. Did EMT do a digital reverberator after the 250?
They did. They did, like, a bunch of them.
Okay.
But those are, like, I mean, it's a lot of this stuff, it's really hard to get information on. I just, like, I troll the internet all the time looking for anything I can. And it's like, you know, like, someone's like, oh, I have a 246, an EMT 246. It's great. But, you know.
Well, a lot of the stuff is discrete, right? Discrete logic?
Yeah, I think so.
So you could reverse engineer it if you wanted to. The older stuff.
Yeah. When do you want to start?
Yeah. Love that, doing that kind of stuff.
So this is another one. So that's actually a wonderful segue to this next slide. This is something, the RMX-16. This is, like, used in a lot of, like, Duran Duran used this, and Peter Gabriel loved these, which is interesting because they had a nonlinear reverb in it, which is based on a gated reverb. I think if you look at it, it's not like a flat slope. It kind of fades in and then goes out a little bit and then cuts out. And I think it is based on the truncated, like, they're trying to actually emulate this specific stone room in a studio in Britain, and the gating of it that was used on the Peter Gabriel album with Intruder on it. Like, this very specific gated sound. I think they weren't they were trying to dial something in. They also, like, I heard this from someone that owned the first, won the first 224s in England back in, like, 80, that the AMS folks, like, hey, do you mind if we borrow that for a week? And they then return it. It was in one piece. So, I mean, it's hard to tell because, like, the AMS stuff doesn't really sound like Lexicon to me. But I think they might have some basic kind of ideas there. I don't know. But that's something we'll get back to, like, kind of, like, I mean, there's, like, the reverse engineering thing, there's been a lot of different takes on it. I mean, it's, like, these things, like, people, ever since, it's interesting. It's like, I mean, this jumping a little bit, but, like, you know, in 1981, they're reverse engineering, like, they're looking at a reverb from 1979. There's an algorithm in the 224, the constant density plate, where the first 6 reflections are identical to the first 6 reflections of the EMT-250. The rest of it isn't the same, but people were looking at this stuff. Now, like, that's an expensive thing to do with that money. But there's, like, a lot of stuff. Like, so, like, a lot of creative stuff in the 80s. They were really started going out of, does this sound like a concert hall? Let's get some things in here that sound interesting. Like, nonlinear means it basically lasts for X amount of time and then just stops. Reverse is, like, people used to do, like, reverbs where they, like, flip the tape, put a reverb on it like a plate, flip the tape again, and then, like, so the sound is forward, but the reverb comes, fades in. And you could do, like, similar technique to the nonlinear reverbs. You could do that where it's like, make it sound like that. Now, it could, you can't have it come out before the sound because of causality, but you can kind of get that, and then like lots of super modulated reverbs, and then there's this thing like this. This is more of a specific thing, shimmer, which is a reverb in a feedback loop with a pitch shifter. And they used a 224, Eno and Lanois, which is funny because Brian Eno talks about how he owns very little stuff. He has like two synthesizers that he owns, but he worked at nice studios. So he, you know, have a 224, put in a feedback loop with an AMS pitch shifter, have a Lexicon modulated delay in there. And the feedback, this would be a good time to show you some examples of those. So let's go back to Logic. So I'm going to go back to that original synth. Let's first of all hear a gated sound. So Tom's Diner. This is a very, like, this has been kind of a standard reverb testing plugin or sound since it came out in like 89 or something. I don't know.
I am sitting in the,
let's turn off that.
The diner on the corner. I am,
and go back to Vintage Verb, which is right here. I'm going to go to a preset, a nonlinear gate, because this gives you an idea of what it is. Let's turn. Let's solo that. Oh, shoot. Let's solo that. Different that. I'm comically bad at computers. So this is like just the reverb of that. And here you can tell it's like it's kind of a low bandwidth. You can make it brighter. And you can start hearing the chattering as you turn it up. You can smooth out the chattering. But the idea is that like it's just a fixed duration. You can change that duration. Or you can make it really big. Now, I have the attack here. This allows you to like get truncated things. So like, that sounds like a room, but let's make it shorter. So like, but it ends a little bit too early. As you, there you can hear it's like it's like something dying away, and then it stops. But that same thing is like basically what this is like. It's a simple summary. It's a multi-tap delay line where the output taps are weighted for the curve that you want. So if you have them all the same thing, let's go back to the beginning of this song because we have to hear it over and over again. Because we're about to, oh, hang on. What am I doing? Sorry about this, folks.
It doesn't want to go back. I don't want to do that again.
So that's like this discrete sort of like, or like very continuous, but like if you make the attack so that it fades in. You get that backwards sound.
Over that.
Yeah. That's the preset name.
Or MIDI verb, yeah. Something like that.
Exactly. So it was like that was a very big sound in the 80s. The reverse, the gated. And like it sounds like on drums, it make the drums sound very big. Now, some of the other things, like we've heard the big modulated sounds. Let's go back to the Blade Runner example. I'm going to play something, an example of the shimmer sound. Now, shimmer is something that like they used to do with a big feedback loop. When I first started Valhalla DSP, it's like, you know, I'm really interested in that sound. And I had thoughts about like how can you do that in a plugin where basically the reverb network and the pitch shifting network are designed to work very well with each other. In a way, and that has more to do with like how the feedback is routed and stuff like that. So let me just play this Blade Runner example. Oh, wait. How do I delete that? Okay.
Your
reverb. Oh, thank you. And so let's just bring that in, and then I'm going to bring in the shimmer sound I think I have set up on bus 4. and we're listening to track two. So. Kind of subtle.
I can hear something going on there.
Oh yeah, the interface of that.
Ah.
One thing is, like, I really like when I started doing the graphics. I remember I drew something. I had something in mind, but I didn't know what it was. My wife drew something that had like circles with lines in them, and I was just like, "That's it." I loved it because it's like it almost seems like a parody of an interface. It's kind of like, it's very minimal. I love like mid-50s Swiss graphic design, but I also just love the idea of like, this is like, what do you really need to define it? Because I want to go as far away from wood and distressed paint and metal and air vents and handles as possible. Now there's like, and it's not because like, oh, that's skeuomorphic or whatever. I mean, there's times that that's actually, if you're basing it on a piece of hardware, that's actually kind of useful, but it's just, my aesthetic is different than that. So I think that covered all those kind of 80s sounds that we're talking about. And the shimmer was never, like, that wasn't available in boxes back then. People just sort of jerry-rigged it. Like, I think in 88, who was it? Eventide came out with the H3000 that had a feedback, pitch-shifting backwards thing that could get a kind of similar sound, but not really the same thing. And now, and then it just some along the way just got, like, I've heard it called Octaverb and all that, but Shimmer is just sort of the name that it's called now. So, play. I wonder if it's like, and I talk about the 90s, and it's like, that's my only slide on that. It's like, I think basically reverb started getting more advanced. They actually, like, they weren't having to do, like, you get more processing power. They don't necessarily have to do the tricks that they used to do. They could use more, like, more what I call advanced algorithms to get more physically correct. You could model a whole bunch more early reflections, and you could do, like, a much, you know, like, a feedback delay network that is very complicated for the late reverb. And I list a couple, like, TC Electronics are very well regarded in Percasti. The others, it's interesting, because it's like the advances that happened. A lot of people still prefer the old reverbs at this point. But these modern ones, like, you know, the Percasti, people rave about that. And it's like, it's good for, like, that can be good for stuff where it's like you want little or no reverb, or you want a much more realistic sound. It's like, as you can hear, like, those things I just played, you know, they're not realistic at all. But like a lot of these reverbs are going to be used in tracks that you wouldn't think have reverb in them.
And it sounds like recording practices have kind of come full circle, where I see a lot of engineers are doing room mics, you know, and the like, and the studio I'm familiar with that has a Percasti that seems to fit into what you're saying, whereas it's more of a...
Yeah, you know, and, like, I think, like, the Percasti does a good... Like, it's like, I think he designed it... Casey, the designer of it, said that he heard the first Death Cab for Cutie album, and... because he was working at Lexicon at the time, and he heard the first Death Cab for Cutie album, and he's like, he really wanted something that would get the drum sound of that, which is room mics in some, I think, wherever, which I don't even know if it was a studio or if it was their, like, space that they were doing, and he just really wanted that very realistic sound. And it's useful nowadays, because it's like, studios are, there's not as many as there used to be, and they're expensive. And, like, you know, and, like, you know, like, if I put a room, I was like, I could probably have a great sounding drum set in my living room. Unfortunately, that's where all our stuff is in my family's room. And they may not want me to be doing, I mean, like, you know, that it just that standard sort of stuff. So this is something just like I was playing around with, the idea of the reverb grimoire, which is just, it's like, the thing is, and this is from, like, just to point out, this is from the view of me as, like, an outsider. I've never worked for any of these companies, like the software companies. But like basically, it's like physical reverbs. You knew what was going on. You know, it's like, look at the back of the plate. Look at the patents. Mm-hmm. Look at, walk into the chamber. You're in the hall. It's like, it's a room. It's not an image three. And then like, but then like the digital reverbs that came from like Schroeder, those were published. But starting with the commercials one, they stopped publishing it. It's like, well, I guess, you know, because it's like, this is a unique thing. It's like, there's probably one of the first audio pieces of gear that you, that a real, you know, a good electrical engineer, or your average good electrical engineer couldn't just open it up and tell you how it works. It's not just like, oh, well, this is a schematic and this tube and all that. It's like, here's all these parts, and then that doesn't tell you how it works. There's software that works with it. And they don't tell you how that software works. They didn't tell you how that software works because why would they? They could patent it. After 17 to 20 years, that lapses. Lexicon still has plugins that like are based on stuff that they're doing in the 80s. They've got a lot. I mean, like, it's basically, it's like these ideas. I mean, it's something that. And the other thing about that is that it's like, so there's like in this, you kept having reverb papers published in the Journal of Audio and Engineering Society and elsewhere. And they went into the different areas. They went into what's called feedback delay networks, which is basically you have a whole bunch of delays in parallel. You combine them with the matrix and you feed them back on themselves.
Is that the Moore reverb?
No, that would be like a JOT. Okay. J-O-T. Also, Michael Gerzon did work on it in 1971, 1972. But very few people ever saw those papers because they're like in this British journal that there's only a couple of libraries in the U.S. that got it. And it's like, I know that like, I finally found a copy in the early 2000s after 3 years of looking for it, and it had property of Christopher Moore stamped on it, who was this reverb, and it has little notes. It was awesome. It's just like, it had like little notes about what he thought was cool about that. And then they did physical models where they might have waveguides connected. And I think commercial reverbs use something different, and it's, I was like, not going to go into too much details. I mean, I've talked about the loops and stuff, but it's like, but the thing is, it's like, it's, there's been this theory that evolves in commercial reverbs. And a lot of reverb companies, it's like, I mean, I think a lot of them have peeked at each other's work and done studying. But what it is like you do have, it's like you've got something that sounds different from the academic stuff. Because honestly, there's very few academic papers of published reverbs that you can implement it and it sounds any good. Mm-hmm. They give you kind of a basic thing. And then even like I've, you know, and this is me speaking from experience, because I've done the feedback delay networks. I've done the something else's, various something else. And it's like, I've done a lot of things and there's different sounds and you can hear the characteristics of these. And so there's advantages of doing like the, like the, there's this is kind of like school of development that happened. And I think of it as kind of like archaeology. And it's like, you know, it's like, you know, but like the people that know what's going on, it's like, it's either they don't, you know, like, you know, archaeology, they're long gone. People that are doing this in the industry, they've got NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, not going to talk about it. And you can take guesses, you might be wrong. But this is where I'm interested. I guessed on some of this stuff. I might be wrong, but it's like, it's an interesting enough wrong. And if it sounds good,
have you had a chance to look, or do you have any opinion about the Sony Oxford reverb?
I haven't checked that one out. I think, like, what I've heard, like, yeah, it's like, I'd have to take a look at that and see how, like, but I think there's, like, a lot of these, like, a lot of the reverbs do kind of, like, a lot of commercial reverbs, it'd be interesting to see if it, like, if it's a feedback delay network or if it's the something else type thing, the kind of something else.
How different are convolution reverbs in their design than
algorithms? Convolution reverbs are math. They're math theory. It's basically, it's just like convolution is a defined operation, like just has that little asterisk in it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, basically the convolution reverbs, there's, it really comes down to how good, it's not really like the theory of it. It's like, how good is your math? But there's also tricks, like what tricks can you do to efficiently do this and without latency? And that's where it gets interesting with convolution reverbs, because there's been patents about it and kind of like controversy about the patents and all that. And I personally, I think it's like convolution reverb can sound great for some things and sounds kind of dead for other things because there's no movement in the sound. But I also think convolution is just like, I feel like right now convolution is probably, it's like, it's where we were at the early days of digital reverbs. And then it's like, it's a building block that eventually is like, you know, the way that computers are going, it will be used for something in the future because, like, computers can process convolution very efficiently because of, like, the processors they have. But it's also, for me, it's like, I looked into it's like, it's, I like the art. I like the art of just, like, designing these ad hoc things, like, take a bunch of delay lines, figure out how to combine them together and feed them back on themselves and have it sound good. And you've got 16 of them or 32 or 28 or it turns out there's like an infinite number of ways of configuring them. And like, that's something, it's like getting the mindset of the gurus, like a beard helps. Just going from left to right, this is, let's see, that's Christopher Moore, I believe, who is Ursa Major Reverbs and then did stuff for AKG, later designed for Kurzweil. That's Anthony Agnello, who did stuff for Eventide in the early days and is now back at Eventide. This is Wolfgang, is it Buchleitner? The Quantec guy. And this is David Griesinger. And like, it's, you see these pictures of the old reverb guys, and they have these magnificent beards. I mean, just like
Griesinger was from where?
Just Vikings walking the earth. I mean, it's just like it's fantastic. And like, there's another picture, like Barry Blesser's in this picture is like, you know, with this, like, and they just, like, they have, he's got just a huge, just yep. Wonderful beard too. It's just
like, time had a different meaning to it.
Was it some AES convention or something?
Oh, yeah, it's like an early, it looks like an early 80s AES convention.
That's pretty cool.
It's awesome.
It's like after the face stops.
Yeah. Little reverb tail there.
So, like, I mean, just, like, this is something that's, like, you know, like, if you were interested in that, like, even though it's, like, it's never been officially published, but there's been hints dropped. And some of them's, like, Bill Gardner was a guy that worked in the Bay Area, and he's published some papers, but they look kind of similar. Like, his voice talked about, he said at one point, this is kind of based on what I learned in the industry. John DeToro is a guy with an interesting history who worked at Lexicon and then went on to Insonic. And what I heard from a guy in Sonic is that they got a 224 and reverse engineered it, like did like logic scanners and stuff like that. So, you know, and that's so some of the Insonic algorithms were based on that. And he published one in a Journal of Audio Engineering Society in a 3-part article where 2 parts came out and the third one didn't come out till like 7 years later or something like that. Because I think some people got upset, and it's like, especially because, well, there's a lawsuit involved that he won. You can look it up. He has it on his website. Keith Barr is the late reverb, the guy who actually founded MXR and then founded Alesis. And he has talked about, like, his stuff is not, like, he said, like, I one day, like, I got a 224, ran some signals, looked at it on a scope, and kind of figured out the basic idea. And so he has published reverbs on his site that aren't really exactly like the 224, but it's sort of the same thing. So if you are interested, Spin Semiconductor has some theory on their website.
When you mentioned the Insonic, did you mean the original Insonic?
Mm-hmm. It's like, it would have been like on the DP4 processor and then like the EPS-16 and ASR-10 sampler. Well, EPS-16 sampler, I think maybe ASR-10 by... Later, in, like the later in Sonics, they actually moved over to a feedback delay network, so they did more published stuff. But and that's the thing, is like this is something that you just look around. I mean, it's like I'm a nerd about this. I literally did a freeze frame on a demo video from Universal Audio where they're talking about the EMT250, and they show the schematic. Well, the crossfade of it is blurry, but it's like, I mean, and it reminds me, I'm, it's like, it's kind of like that classic, the Patterson film where you see Bigfoot kind of doing this thing. And you have that one freeze frame. And it's just like, yeah. So I'm sitting there and looking at that, and it's like, oh, okay, that looks like that's linear interpolation. It's kind of pathetic.
So Rick over here used to work with Keith Barr.
Yeah, he was a great man.
I was felt lucky, like in, like because like I was on the forum at Spin Semiconductor, and then I got into an email exchange with him, and like just from that, it was just like, I mean, one, he's just such a helpful guy, and yeah. Just like the discussion, he was so enthusiastic. It's like, you know, just like talk about it, like try this. It's like try doing this like an all pass loop where you write into it in a whole bunch of places and read out from one place. And it sounds great. It just keeps building over time. It's just really,
yeah,
like...
He was very enthusiastic, and it was contagious to work for him. It was really exciting. And, you know, I was one of his, like, I wouldn't say minions, but more like, you know, apostle. You know, we'd all just kind of gather around. And he was, like, just the sage advice, you know, from up high. It was
probably great. Learned a lot.
And I didn't write about Alesis in here, but I... Personally, a lot of the music that I've loved was done with Alesis reverbs. Like, there's in the 90s, there's this record label, Warp Records, and so bands like Aphex Twin, Autechre, Square Pusher, Boards of Canada, they all use the quad reverb and the MIDI verb too. For some reason, it's really those two. That's like the MIDI verb two, and quad reverb were the ones that just like, and those had some just fantastic sounds in them. And it's like this darker sound, and they had their own, like I talked about. Truncation noise. They had this weird, I think, at least he talks about it in his like book they published, this like floating point delay memory, and I think that adds this noise to it.
Yeah, I have a lot of those still in my garage somewhere. If you're interested,
I've got
listening to them. Yeah. But he's yeah. Also the first guy to come out with the digital reverb under $1,000.
Exactly.
I was going to say, you know, I know you use a lot of different reverbs and plugins and stuff, but the Alesis reverbs are the ones that changed my life, because just like in the same way that Mackie mixers changed people's lives, because suddenly you could get something that worked and it was clean and it didn't cost $5,000, mm-hmm. And you can hold it in one hand.
In one of the emails, like he wrote up a little history. I've got on my blog where it's, like he talked about the history of the original MIDI verb, and he said like just the cost of those reverbs like it offended his sensibilities. So his goal is like, how do I do this as cheap as possible? So he came up with one that I don't think it really had a multiplier in it. It had like just basically a bit shift so that you could have like a coefficient of, you could have the coefficients of 0, negative, you know, 0, negative 1, 1, 0.5, and negative 0.5. And so everything was built with that, but building stuff with that, he started coming up with these algorithms, these ones called Bloom, where the sound fades in over time. And it's totally based on the artifacts of doing that. And it's just, and he's like, and he talks about drawing up this chip on like a light board and doing it by hand.
Yeah, it's the first, it was the XT1000 was the first reverb. And he told me that he was kind of down to his last few dollars. So after MXR, I got a lot of money with MXR. He kind of went through that. He took the window pane out of his garage and put with tape, did the original PC board for the XT1000.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, he was that kind of guy. He had that focus and that dedication.
That is great.
Audio work logic. I gotta go.
Take it easy.
Thanks.
Nice meeting
you. Awesome talk.
So, like, it's like, because I was just talking about, like, you know, talking about this, like, what I've done is, like, I just try everything. So I, like, basically, I've read every paper I can find on this, and then I just try to implement everything. I've written so many reverbs. I've written hundreds of them, and most of them just suck. They're just failures. Just like, wow, this sounds so bad. Or it's like, and ideas I think are great are bad. And I come back to it a few years later. It's like, oh yeah, that sucks. That's still a bad idea. Why do I keep thinking that somehow this idea is going to be better? And some of these, a few dozen are decent. And then every now and then I go back to an idea that I tried before. It's like, oh, I just didn't know what I was doing then. Now I do this, and therefore that's going to do it. Or it's like, oh, I just had a bug in the code. It wasn't the idea.
And let's see. As a point of reference, Dave Grissinger would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. He would write dozens and dozens of these loops trying to get one that sounded right. It's not totally intuitive. It eventually became, after many years, it started to become intuitive. But he struggled with it too. It's not always when you're setting out to get a certain sound, it isn't spelled out in all pass networks. It takes a lot of just trial and error.
And that's how I feel it is. Like you have to learn, like the qualities of it. Like I still am learning the qualities of feedback delay networks. And I spent like like I did, like when I did Vintage Verb, I kind of like, I'm diving into all past networks and then understood it. And then it's like a year later, I revisit it. And it's like, you know, I spend some time, like, I didn't get this. There's parts I'm missing. There's parts of like the, and like the clip is like, you know, just like you just keep going back to it. And then another thing is just like listening to it. It's like you have to listen to the results. And then it's better to get, like, there's people out there with better ears than you. Or, well, the better ears than me. Maybe all you guys might have better ears than me. It's
like, at least they're different ears.
Different ears. And like, and that's the whole thing. Someone said, like, oh, well, like, listen, though, this guy Don Gunn, I do a lot of work with. He's like, you hear that bloom in the bass, how it blooms over time? It's just like, I didn't, but now I do. Now it's like, you know, it's like, you know, and you get beta testers, but it's like, it's also like, I find it's like, getting stuff out in the world is so great, because like when you go up from like a few users to a lot more users, like you get feedback and you get people saying like, and you start understanding when people say, I like this, I don't like that. Okay, can you do something like this? Like, why would you want that? And then it's like over time you just start understanding that. But it's like my ears have changed. It's just like I find myself hearing details that I would never heard a decade ago. I just didn't hear that stuff in reverbs.
What do you listen on?
Well, I listen on, I mean, I was like, some of those things is like, I've got some examples. Like, I have some standard things because, like, the Tom's Diner I hear. But the more is like, I like.
With headphones, though? Is it
always? Oh, no, I have speakers at home, but I generally go over to Don Gunn's studio when I'm actually tuning it. He's got, his room is tuned so nice, and he's constantly working on getting it good. It's like, I just know, it's like, look, my room, I don't know how to set up a room like that. And that's the sort of thing, like, I can hear my stuff on my desk at home. It's like, okay, well, that sounds pretty good, but it's like, the 3D effect is the sort of thing you really need to be in a good studio environment to hear that sort of stuff, versus, like, because otherwise you get room reflections and all that. So, but it's also just, like, have, you know, a number of beta testers and stuff like that, but it's more just, like, the beta testers, it's like, you can have dozens of people doing it, and then you have it for sale, you have a few hundred people doing it, and they'll tell you, one, oh, no, this is crashing. Which is not fun. It's like, oh, and this DAW. It's like, you know, because like there's 80 plus digital audio workstations out there in the world, and you can't tell, and they're changing all the time. And, you know, Apple is like changing all the time. It's like, you know, it's like building sandcastles, and Apple and Avid are the sea. They're just washing it away constantly.
It's like my teenage son listens to his music through the iPhone, the dinky speaker, and it just drives me crazy. I'm like, how could you listen to it? Like, look, I got an old Rance 2230. I'll hook it up with some Celestials in your room if you want. He's like, it doesn't have Bluetooth.
I know, and that's what I found. Like, I've been listening to some stuff. It's like, okay, I'm getting these records where I want to listen to the reverb on. Like, I'm getting them on vinyl, and it's just nice to hear things that way. Just like get the right spatial sort of configuration. But like when I'm developing stuff, it's like, I mean, I did just get like the synthesizer that I can play stuff through, but that's more just an excuse to have the synthesizer. I that Tom's Diner I played. Another song is like, it's, there's kind of like, you look for songs that have no reverb, as dry as possible. And this song is such a wonderful song, and I've ruined it for myself. Mm-hmm. But let's see. Oh.
I saw it written and I saw it say.
So you can hear that's very dry. It's a very just beautiful song. And I've heard it so many million times. And I've ruined it for myself. But when you hear it enough times, it's like frog vision. Frogs don't see what there is. Frogs see anything that changes. Like, they look at something, and it just goes blank, and so anything that moves across that background shows up instantly. It's like, it's this weird receptor thing. And so that's kind of how I am with reverbs at this point. Like, I don't hear the song, I just hear how it's different. So it's like, I can hear, it's like... Oh, that's... Never mind. That's shimmered.
That's not
this volume...
So you do stuff like that. You'll stop it, listen to how the tail goes, you listen to it running, you listen to it stop, you listen to it, you know, but it really is like you have to listen to it in the context of a mix. Like one of the reverbs I showed, the RMX-16, if you listen to that by itself, it sounds metallic and not that great, but then you put it into a mix and it just kind of melts and turns 3D. So,
how about the frequency? In other words, you're listening to some lower frequencies, it may sound fine. You listen to some higher frequencies and it may not sound so fine.
Oh, absolutely. And that's just like, and that's part of it is like, you know, when you go into a testing process, you'll have people that just like will be doing all sorts of stuff with it. Well, you know, I think that's kind of, I look here, I think that's about the end of my presentation. So if people have questions, then feel free to ask.
Well done.
Great. Excellent.
Impulse response reverbs. Convolution?
Is it convolution or what
it is that? Convolution. It's like what they do is that they have some signal and like they'll play a signal through a speaker or octagonal seats, you know, like or dodecahedron speaker, or if you're in a place that you can't get a speaker, you'll have like a starter pistol or balloon.
And well, they have it built into Logic now. They have an IR and they have instructions. I just did like a sine wave sweep is what they told me to do.
Yeah.
And then I did like a loud clap and they just sound like crap, but I mean, it's because I have a bad room. So.
Well, but there's all, I mean, I think they're very useful. I also think it's like convolution is a creative process. You could put anything in there.
Yeah.
Like you could put a musical phrase in there and convolve with that and just get, it's like instant space music.
Yeah, that's right.
And I also think it's really good for like short sounds. And another place where I love convolution is for Foley. It's like, it's great for like, you know, getting the room tone of a room.
Well, as a theatrical sound designer, I find convolution reverbs way more useful than algorithm reverbs.
Well, yeah, because I mean, when I worked in video games sound for a while, I remember talking to some guy that had worked at Creative Labs. And Creative Labs is a sound blaster, but they also had this arm that was like doing a lot of research and development. So they had some pretty heavy hitters there. But so they had, like, on the Sound Blaster cards, they had reverbs built in. And, like, there's this game Half-Life that it had, like, it had its own built-in really not good reverb on its own, but it worked well in the game. And so they had gone and done, put these reverbs in the game that were based on this, like, their algorithms. And so, like, you see, like, someone going down this metal corridor, and there's just this lush modulated reverb following him. It just didn't make sense. It's like, that's not what, the world doesn't sound like what you want. Like, a music reverb isn't what the world sounds like necessarily.
So the cool thing about convolution reverb, and this is my experience with it, is there's, you can go online and people just make impulses of weird stuff, you know, weird stuff. And I found one of an EMT-250. And I back when I was doing recording, I threw it all over vocals because that's what you do with an EMT-250, I guess. But the problem is that you don't have any knobs. Because what you would, because the person, the collection of impulses from the EMT-250 is at different settings, so it's really is just a snapshot, you know, at that setting. So
you have like a mix knob. How much?
You have a mix knob. That's right. But you don't have you don't have all the controls, you know, to do it. And I guess, I mean, I perceive your reverbs as what I would say are creative reverbs, like, you know, for creative use, and convolution for, I would say, more like a technical use would be great, you know, like you were saying.
Yeah, post-production is like, like people ask, what's a good, you have a surround reverb post-production? It's like, I don't, I mean, but that's more for the music, for the post, I mean, I could see where it's like, a post-production algorithmic reverb would be useful so you could just dial in things really quick.
Yeah.
But then it's like, well, it should probably have about 8 knobs on it at most. Because if you're dialing in really stuff, it's like it's going to be easier at that point to just swap in several impulses until you get what you want.
That should be like a user interface study, like how many seconds per knob
does it cost? I can tell you, it's like, I mean, it's not a user interface study, but I can tell you, like, there's probably a sweet spot when it comes to sales. It's like, as far as, like, I found that my knobbiest thing is not my biggest seller at all. It's my least biggest seller. It's like, I think that there's like people, and people talk about how they want complexity in forums, but that's not necessarily what people doing the work want. It's like people doing the work don't necessarily, like, you know, it's like there's people like, oh, I want to sit there and dial stuff in. It's like other people want to, like, I want to turn this knob and have it work and go. I mean, like a lot of classic, you know, it's like I was thinking about the MXR Phase 90. That has one knob.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, what settings is it? Great, 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 great.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of, that's why a lot of live sound guys like the PCM60, right? Because it's just...
Yeah, that thing is amazing. And oh, that's and has just a great sound. It's interesting you're talking about the EMT250, because I have a kind of model of it. I changed the late reverb, but one thing about that is that it has, like, why the convolution is that it's very time variant. It's like, that's the one that had 300 milliseconds, so it's modulated all over the place just to get any sort of sound out of it.
Oh.
So let's just turn that up. Like, so here it is without modulation. Let's turn up the modulation.
Yeah.
It goes from ringy to like, and they were just modulated. Like, I've heard samples of it. It's like, I've never played an EMT 250 because there's like 250 of them made. And they're, yeah, you know, the ones that are still running are in very high-end studios. So, but they have like very fast modulation. So, and like, so the decay, like, And the thing why I bring that up is because convolution is just going to get a weird snapshot of it. It's either going to capture it at just one, like, if you're freeze framing the, it's like, it's either, like, imagine, like, seeing, like, someone jumping through the air, like taking a picture of something, like a skateboard or something. You either get a perfectly defined freeze frame of just that person hanging in space, which just looks like, well, that person's not levitating. That's not actually what's going on. Or you just get this blur. And that's the problem with, like, convolution taking snapshots of these older modulated reverbs. But then again, but the blurring might do some sort of averaging. Taking that convolution impulse might do some sort of averaging that actually makes it sound better than a time invariant version of that might be. So it might be like, it might some, but the only problem with averaging is that you also might get less of the high, because it with averaging also kind of gets rid of the treble. And that's been something you've talked about with convolution, is like, how much do, in a larger space, how much are you accurately capturing it? Because, you know, like, if you hear, like, if you just, everyone's quiet for a second. You hear the air conditioning? That's changing the air currents and the temperature in the room, and the speed of sound is different for different temperatures. So you have different areas, and that's time varying, which means if you take an impulse response of a room like that, and then take an impulse response a couple seconds later, it might be very different. And if the impulse response, depending on how it is, there might be averaging within the impulse response itself, so you may get some high frequency attenuation that you don't get. And I honestly think that might be why, like, different convolution reverbs sound different from each other, is that they have different measurement techniques, and some might, like, I've heard some just, everyone loves them. It's like, well, maybe they have a way of taking an impulse that just is a great way of dealing with that.
Yeah, kind of going along with your theme of your talk is the sometimes the limitations don't give you what you expect, but it's still...
Yeah, you know, it might give you something new. You had a question?
Yeah, I've noticed in experimenting with this vintage bird at home, the shape control, the size, I'm not exactly sure what it's doing, but it has a kind of like, it almost at the smaller sizes adds a kind of pattern echo, but it's more pleasing, and it's not more interesting than that. And I'm just kind of curious if you...
Oh, size in most digital reverbs just basically pretty much linearly shrinks the reverb network in the way that it's like the whole thing, the lengths of stuff are scaled. And that's the case in here in all these reverbs except for the concert hall, whereas like I found on like the concert hall, you might want to have part of it not shrinking. But the overall length has to be the same, so the that ended up being some tricks I had to do. But in most plug-in reverbs, size is just scaling that, but you don't necessarily know what it goes from what percentage to what percentage of the real length. Now, that's not like in, I know other reverbs, like I think the Bricasti, I've heard that it doesn't do that. Size is basically, would be increasing the, like probably changing the attack of how the late reverb goes in. Because that's something that you also have in a real physical space, is that bigger rooms have a little bit slower reverb attack. They take longer fading, like a, you know, concert hall takes a little bit of time. Cathedral can be up about to half a second to fade in.
So are you saying so often, I guess in the reverb, I don't know if this one is like this, but there'll be the delay lines with, you know, prime number
or you know, whatever magic numbers you've selected for those delay lines, you're saying that the size would as a bank kind of shrink or lengthen those.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like some reverbs actually will do something where, you know, as you change that size, they will snap to the nearest prime numbers.
Yeah.
I personally don't believe the prime number thing. That's just something that's coming around.
That's how you get the sound around. Right?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably just, but it's like, I think it's one of those things like, I've done it before, and it's like, I think it's just like snapping two numbers can work just fine. But it's also, it's like, you know, it gives you something that's like, look, it's going to be me, but the it's interesting because it's like, unless you have a reverb that every single delay line is a fractional delay, like an interpolated delay, when you change the size, you will be changing, it's going to be snapping to integers, and those integers might be different. So I was like, the size will change, it's not just scaling, it's going to change the sound of it, but not as nearly as dramatically as just what changing the size will do. I mean, it's like, oh, are those the same? It's like, well, yeah, but now it's like you've got just a few hundred milliseconds of delay versus like couple of seconds, so that's going to change it more dramatically. Any questions?
Yeah. I just want to. You have free demos of your stuff, right?
Yeah, you can like download them.
I
and
thought you might want to mention that.
Oh yeah.
Somebody wants to experiment with your software.
Yeah, it's like it's like you go. I guess this is a hot thing. Go to ValhallaDSP.com and you can download demos of the stuff that, like, basically you can install them, and they're the same as the full version, except for there's the sound fades out and then back in every 45 seconds.
Well, I think we should probably
call it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Can we
get a